Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In the first segment of our show, we'll hear from Ian Hilly, who will be telling us a little bit about hemochromatosis. So tell me a little bit about the society.
Well, the Canadian Hemochromatosis Society was established by Marie Warder probably close to 40 years ago in a town called Delta, which is part of Greater Vancouver today. That's where she lived. And she set up the society because she had such a challenge to get her husband diagnosed with his ailment, with his problem, that wound up being hemochromatosis, that she felt that she wanted to provide a service to other people who may be on the same journey.
So, how does hemochromatosis typically affect a person?
Hemochromatosis, simply put, is too much iron or iron overload, and it can affect a person in a number of different ways. So, for example, they can become arthritic, they can have calcification of the joints, diabetes is often seen in people with hemochromatosis. The key organ that gets affected is the liver. So liver diseases like liver cirrhosis and ultimately liver cancer can be issues. A symptom of hemochromatosis can be the bronzing of the skin. So one looks jaundiced, but it's sometimes called the bronze disease. There are a few examples. There have been occasions where, sadly, folks have died suddenly, some heart issue, and it's wound up being established that that person has had hemochromatosis. And we've been the recipient of the generosity of families where they have had such incidents in their family where somebody has died all of a sudden of a heart attack, and it's later put down to hemochromatosis.
So, can you tell me a little about the society's work? What exactly they're doing?
Spreading the word is the number one objective of the society. So creating awareness of something that is fairly common. It could affect over 100,000 Canadians based on their genetic makeup. Our quest is to make sure that this disorder is diagnosed and diagnosed early, and that people are not scared by the diagnosis, and they understand how they can manage the disorder if diagnosed early. And we support folks who contact the society with questions via Facebook or by phone or by email. And we also do presentations to try and increase government awareness that early diagnosis is really the cure to this disorder.
So, are there any challenges in providing awareness?
Yeah. The challenges of creating awareness are tremendous. We have ventured in 2018 into using Facebook as a massive vehicle for reaching people. We are trying to reach people across Canada through social media. This is a big step forward for a society with very small financial means. And so I'm really grateful to you today, Cam, for airing our story on your radio station. It's very important that we reach as many people as possible. And we have to repeat the message over and over because clearly we don't get everybody all in one shot.
So, in your time with the Society, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
The successes are, for example, this May has traditionally been Hemochromatosis Awareness Month, and that was established by Marie because that was the month of her husband's birthday. And we've had success this year on a few fronts. Number one, we started a big Facebook campaign and a trial run specifically in British Columbia. We reached over 500,000 British Columbians and generated visits to our website, and specifically to an element of our website which enables someone to do some self-diagnosis. So for a three-minute interaction, we had about more than 1,500 people go to our website and review their own symptoms against what are the typical symptoms of hemochromatosis. And we hope that they have found out that they either have hemochromatosis because they've taken the next steps to go see their doctor, talk about their family history, have a blood test, and maybe even then have a genetic test. And then they can manage their lives accordingly. And then others, obviously, who may not have hemochromatosis and hopefully have been set on a path to be diagnosed for some other condition that they can manage. That's a big success for us. We also had a very successful meeting with parliamentarians in Ottawa. We presented the story of the Hemochromatosis Society at a reception in May as a vehicle to create awareness through members of parliament, and then those members of parliament reaching out to their constituents and telling them, well, we met the Canadian Hemochromatosis Society. Surprise, surprise, that some of our MPs in Ottawa and some of their staff members in Ottawa actually have hemochromatosis. So they were obviously some of the most interested people in what we had to say. But those people can now share the message and be missionaries for our awareness.
Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This next segment of our show, we'll hear a little bit of an update from Sukaina Dada from Disability Rights Promotion International. So what can you tell me about the latest happenings with your research?
So that's a great question. I've
you know, I'm getting really into this, the research on human rights issues concerning Syrian refugees living in Canada. So Syrian refugees who've already settled here, particularly Syrian refugees living with disabilities. And, you know, after talking to so many people and, you know, whether individuals themselves or caregivers or parents, grandparents, other family members, everyone is kind of saying the same thing, that it, you know, they're very grateful for being in Canada. They were, you know, they're grateful for having a different type of living situation and coming away from the war. But everybody is having a very difficult time navigating the healthcare system. And I feel like to some extent I understand this, because even without being a refugee, as an occupational therapist, I find navigating the healthcare system for any of my clients was always such, you know, such a difficult thing to do. You know, having a diagnosis and then not knowing where to go to access funding, not knowing where to go to get support or services. But imagine then being new to the country, not speaking the language, and not sort of knowing, you know, the healthcare culture, and then being thrown into it's really difficult.
Isn't there a kind of an extreme medical risk when it comes to that sort of thing? Say a new immigrant who hasn't mastered the language comes in and they say, this is what's wrong with me, and the symptoms come out one word when they meant another. Isn't that kind of a risk for them?
I mean, I think it could be. I think what we're seeing a lot of, especially with Smile Canada, the organization that I work with, what we're seeing a lot of is when children and their families are coming to Canada, they're being told that their child has something that many of them have never heard about before and don't have prior knowledge. So, for example, you know, kids being diagnosed with autism. You know, many families are saying, no, this child does not have autism. This child has PTSD, and this child is selectively mute, or this child is not engaging socially because he or she grew up in a refugee camp their entire life. And it's difficult because we're quick to jump the gun and say, nope, the child has autism. Here are the assessments that we did. But how much do we know about these other conflicting factors?
Well, the way it comes down sometimes is medical science, kind of seen on the assembly line principle. People want to get things diagnosed, they want it done fast, and on to the next one. Can't work that way.
Definitely. And I think, you know, to a great extent, like as a rehabilitation specialist, I know firsthand that to a great extent, like our disciplines are segregated. You know, rehabilitation science, acute medicine, mental health, when really they shouldn't be segregated, because an individual might be experiencing one thing that might mimic something else, but they might be actually, you know, having different reasons for experiencing something and for presenting in a certain way. And I think, you know, I think we have to be really cautious, you know, especially working with people who have come from a war zone, has come from, you know, a place where they've lost everything and they've been, you know, maybe malnourished or undernourished, and, you know, we sort of throw them into this system. I think we have to really involve them every step of the way. And my research and my research stems from a fear of mine, actually. And my fear is that we're not involving individuals themselves in the process. We're more telling them what is best for them.
Well, the worst thing you could possibly do to somebody coming in who has lost everything, as you say, is to throw them into a system where they're disregarded or overlooked. That's taken away their dignity, which may be the last thing they have.
Yes, and that was never, I mean, that is not what we are saying we are doing as Canadians. But I think to some extent that is what we are doing. And I think we have to acknowledge and be critical of that. I think that's only fair.
So what steps can each of us take to do a little better in this arena?
I mean, for the academics out there, I think we need to do the research. We need to, you know, identify what are the difficulties in navigating the healthcare system. You know, how do we get individuals involved in their access to care, in what they want, and how do we come away from, you know, how do we acknowledge other types of medicine and healthcare and health? So, you know, in Canada, we really rely on Western medicine, and we really rely on rehabilitation. But what are other ways that people can, you know, feel better, if you will? And as individuals or as healthcare providers, I think we need to critically, you know, just ask ourselves, are we really involving the individual? Are we being, you know, are we using a holistic human rights approach? And I think if we're honest about that question, then we can, you know, come to the realization that at times we might not be involving the individual in the process the way we should. Instead, we're more telling individuals, you know, sort of what they have, what they need to do, how they need to feel better. And then I think just as a society, we really have to, you know, reach out to different communities and ensure that we're all on the same team. Like, we're all Canadians. There's a lot of rhetoric around, you know, refugees come here and they take resources and et cetera, and all this nonsense. You know, I guess Canadians that might be seeping in from the South, but that's not what this is. Canada's welcoming refugees. Refugees are in the process of becoming Canadian if they're not already, and they have all the rights that any other Canadian citizen has. So I think we just really need to be critical about what's happening.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you so much, Cam.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Delta Zetas are some of the most devoted students at the University of Windsor. Our sorority is built upon four pillars: academics, sisterhood, philanthropy, and leadership. We are known as successful women on campus and leaders within our community. Right now, we are looking for amazing women to join our sisterhood. For more information, check out Delta Zeta on Facebook.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Ian Hilly, who told us a little bit about hemochromatosis, and from Sukaina Dada from York University, who's giving us an update on her research. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Priscilla Rodriguez from Disability Rights International. So I understand your area of expertise is human trafficking among girls with disabilities.
Among other things, I mean, abuses in general, some of them include trafficking.
So can you give me a bit of an overview of your work?
So with DRI, with Disability Rights International, or DRI, we have documented the situation of persons with disabilities in institutions, including women and girls, and also has conducted a study into the sex and reproductive rights of women with disabilities in Mexico. And what we found is that women with disabilities are faced for sterilization, coerced sterilization as well, forced contraception, and also sexual abuse, violence, and abuses that amount to torture.
So do you find the public is generally aware that these things are happening, or do we need to get the word out a little more?
We definitely need to get the word out a little bit more. We, in general, the public does not know what's going on, especially inside institutions, but I think there's also a lot of stigma based on ignorance, and many times these practices may be approved, such as forced sterilization or forced contraception of women with disabilities, because of ignorance of their rights, but also of the fact that women with disabilities are able, with support, to exercise their sexuality and their motherhood if they wish to.
So, what led you to this area of research in particular?
I'm sorry?
So what led you to have an interest in these particular issues?
Well, I've worked with DRI for over 7 years now, and DRI's expertise is on people in institutions. But I also realized while working with women with psychiatric disabilities in Mexico that many of them had been pressured to take contraceptives or to be sterilized, and some of them even to have an abortion, even though their pregnancies, they had stable partners with whom they had decided to have a baby. So based on these conversations that I had with women with psychiatric disabilities in Mexico, we decided to conduct a study to learn more about the problem and whether it was a systemic issue or it was just related to this particular woman I was interacting with.
So what do you hope will happen as a result of the study? What steps can we take as a public to improve the situation?
I think it's important to raise awareness, to make visible the fact that women with disabilities can be good mothers, but also to raise awareness into the support they need, and also to make it clear that this forced sterilization or forced abortion are abuses that amount to torture, especially when applied to women with disabilities. So to make it clear that it is their right to exercise their sexuality and motherhood, but it is also a crime, a grave human rights violation to deny them that right.
So on the issue of girls with disabilities being trafficked, I had heard that that was part of your area as well. Can you tell me a little about what you learned about that?
What we found is women and girls with disabilities in institutions are being sexually exploited, and under the definition of trafficking in the trafficking protocol, what is called also the Palermo Protocol, it says that a person must be harbored against their will and be exploited. It does not need to be for financial gain. So these women are in institutions. They are detained, essentially. They remain there against their will. Many of them will come across, have tried to escape, and they are not. They are put there against their will, and they are also detained against their will, and they are being sexually exploited. For instance, in one institution, we found that staff was sexually exploiting them, but also outsiders, people who would come and repair, make reparations, etc. We don't know if there was a transaction there for services in return, for sexual services in return for repair services, but women were being sexually exploited. And we define that as a form of trafficking. We've also found that in other countries, Mexico, but mostly, for instance, Guatemala and Kenya, that rely heavily on international aid, people are realizing that having institutions is a profitable business. It's something that people in Western cultures feel inclined to donate to. So they set up orphanages and they recruit children with and without disabilities, girls, women, and many times they're also exploited. Also, they are forced to work at the institution, cleaning, cooking, or there is also sexual abuse. So we also define this as a form of trafficking. And the more common activities, criminal activities that conform to the understanding of trafficking, including, for instance, taking girls and forcing them into prostitution, have also been documented by the ERI, for instance, in Ukraine, but also maybe also and to a certain extent in Guatemala and also Kenya. In Ukraine, the ERI documented this first-handed, but in Guatemala and Kenya, it was authorities who told us that these issues were going on.
So, what message would you send to the people about why we need to stop this and what needs to be done?
I think there are so many issues going on around the world that it's hard to really focus on one, but there needs to be awareness. People need to be made aware of it, and they need to also take action regarding it. For instance, what we found is that many of the institutions that are trafficking girls are receiving funding from Western countries, including Canada. For instance, in Kenya, there is a Canadian website that they gather, I mean, they fundraise for orphanages in Kenya. And the orphanages in Kenya that they are fundraising for are among the most abused we have documented in the country. So understand that not because a place is an orphanage, that's automatically a good thing, that actually donating to this type of institution can actually be harmful and can, in fact, foster the exploitation of these children.
I'd like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Let me just make sure I have this right, just before I go off on a tangent here. These girls, these women with disabilities, are being asked to trade, quote-unquote, services for basic repairs and things of necessity. That's just disgusting. Fact is, these people with disabilities, they have things they have to live with already. They are not there to be a source of gratification for those in power. They are there because they need help and support and the best quality of life possible. It is not the right nor the place of any human being to take advantage of such. It is not something that we can just overlook or pretend is not an issue. We have to do better by society, all society. Whether it's here, there, someplace in between, the rights of a person cannot be denied. Their potential must be allowed to be explored, and that doesn't mean tearing down their lives by committing such a heinous act. The emotional damage, the long-term repercussions, are beyond anyone's ability to calculate. I've talked many times about how abuse can create a disability where one did not exist before. The emotional scars and wounds are no less real than any others in society. I'm just going to say that I hope that report is taken to all the leaders necessary. Just strike a blow against such things. We, the people of the world, do not have the right to exploit our fellow human beings, regardless of how they move, think, walk, what have you. It's just not something that we have a right to do. No matter a person's ability levels, no matter where they come from, they are a human being and should be treated as a precious gem in society, not as something there just for us. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.